Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
Are you focused at all on anything other than alcohol? Yo, Art, you're answering tweets from Flounder76.
Russ Dellinger.
It's all true. Bush Light over Sierra Nevada.
And SI's Pat 40.
You know, probably didn't make 40 withdrawals in those years at Alabama. Nick Saban. Because he's not dumb enough to be his own bag man like Jeremy Pruitt clearly was at Tennessee.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod. And right now it's just Pat and I. Ross, I think, is going to join us, but he's working. And he can't make the pod when we start. We can't push back the pod because we got to go drinking with the pod listeners in like an hour and 15 minutes. So we got to squeeze this. We got a lot going on. But here's the deal. Ross has a job, Pat. Not only does he have a job, he has a job with Yahoo Sports, which means he left Sports Illustrated where he worked with you to come to Yahoo Sports to work with me, which is one more data point that I'm just a much more agreeable and likable person. Charismatic, you would even say.
Oh, yeah, you would, huh? Well, yeah. Remember, I left Yahoo for Sports Illustrated, and Pete Thamel left Yahoo for ESPN. So there's two data points that you're insufferable and almost impossible to work with. So this is just a little small counterbalancing, but doesn't get all the way back to evening the scales.
Fair enough.
3-1 for the Y right now, Pat.
We got Sean. We got me. Maybe we have Ross. Ross, first day of work. Ross, like, I got to do this. I'm like, all right. We got some enthusiasm here on day one. I'm like, I'll take the pod whenever. I got time. Whatever.
First day of work, and he doesn't show up for the Yahoo Sports podcast.
That is true. He did not. So we'll see. He's supposed to be coming in the middle. We will join, but we can't push back. We got thirsty fans. I don't know what the hell.
We got to go drink at Tootsie's.
We got to go to Tootsie's. It's probably just going to be you and me because I'm still not sure anyone will show up. But we'll find out. We'll detail that later in the week, pod. But we're at Nashville. We're in Tennessee. And we got SEC Media Days. And we also have, that broke late last week, the culmination of one of our favorite, Do Your Civic Duties, the Tennessee NCAA compliance case. And the one problem I have with there no longer being NCAA rules is we lose the utmost joy and entertainment from NCAA violation cases.
It's true. We don't get the absolutely ridiculous comments and explanations from Jeremy Pruitt. You know, we don't get the completely, laughable explanations for why people don't know that assistant coaches are paying people off or shoe companies are paying people off. I'm afraid it's kind of all out the window.
I know. We're losing that. Like, as we get through some of these violations, I think there'll be moments that's like, good, right? This shouldn't be a violation. Over 200 individual infractions at Tennessee, including 18 level ones. That's good stuff.
They went hard.
They did. I mean, it just means more. Jeremy Pruitt was given a 6-year show cause penalty. They were fined a bunch of money. Seven other Tennessee assistants and staff members received multi-year show cause orders. But there is no bowl ban, which is the big thing, because this season's Tennessee team might be pretty darn good. And I don't really know if they care about the bowl ban, but they care about the playoff ban that potentially could be there. We will see. So couple items here. Adam Sparks of the Knoxville News Sentinel has done a bang-up job on this story, and it's got all sorts of records from Tennessee on how they responded. This one is both it's comical and then not, because it just shows how absurd these rules really were. But some of the penalties came from August 2020 during the COVID shutdown, and at one point Pruitt gave $300 in a Chick-fil-A bag to a recruit's mom. And he claimed that part of his motivation was the George Floyd situation, which, you know, seemed like a rather weak NCAA. First off, who cares? Like, $300, right? I'm just glad we're at the point where if someone wants needs 300, they get the 300. But he goes, you throw in George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor. Okay, so you're sitting there as a white man, see all this going on, you see these kids suffering. It's pitiful. You sit in a room talking about our coaches, too. We talk about growing up and the circumstances they've been under because it's hard for a white man to understand. I would do it again. I don't think it's breaking the rules. I don't know about y'all, but I got little kids. I hope one of these days I'm dead and gone and somebody does the right thing for them. So sort of funny headline, but actually not a bad explanation by him.
Yeah. Provided we're taking that at face value, and I don't want to assume any other motivation for Jeremy Pruitt there. But, you know, that is one of the things that we are getting past, theoretically, from a rules standpoint, is players have much greater access to money than they used to have, whether it is through name, image, and likeness, or, hey, here's a good thing, Tennessee's $9 million fine is going to the Student Opportunity Fund. And in these sort of situations, probably the player would be able to petition the NCAA and say, hey, my mom needs this money. Can I get $300? And they would be able to say, yeah, here it is. As opposed to the coach going out and getting it from his car and putting it in a Chick-fil-A bag. And that was the other part of that whole thing where the cash-driven lifestyle, as I think was the term.
Yeah. There's a couple more. It's like $3,000 for medical bills. He denied that one. $6,000 for a down payment on a vehicle. He denied that one, but I don't think the NCAA believed it. The big issue is bank records showed that Pruitt and assistant coach Brian Niedermeyer made large cash withdrawals on dates surrounding all expense recruiting visits and alleged payments to recruits, players, and their families. Both said, this is from the Knox News, that didn't mean anything because it's normal for them to have large amounts of cash on hand. Pruitt cited his bank records to show this cash-driven lifestyle. What a great, great line. dates back to his time at Alabama. All right, cue the intrigue. From 2018 to 2020, Pruitt and his wife made 75 four- or five-figure cash withdrawals from the bank account. Now, he earned $3.8 million, but five-figure.
Yeah.
Like $10,000 plus. At Alabama, he made 44 or five-figure withdrawals from 2016 to 2017. Yeah, he said it was no big deal. The cash-driven lifestyle.
Yeah. What is that, Pat?
What is a cash?
Probably didn't make 40 withdrawals in those years at Alabama. Nick Saban, because he's not dumb enough to be his own bag man like Jeremy Pruitt clearly was at Tennessee. The assistant coaches make the withdrawals and make the payments. The head coach is like, what? I didn't know anything. So Pruitt flunked head coach 101 there. But it is interesting. Consistency of that going back to Alabama, and there's been more than a few thousand, more than a few million people who have asserted that Alabama has just been better at doing business the SEC way without getting major sanctions for it. And this is yet another one of those logs on the speculation fire there. But Pruitt too said he just keeps large sums of money in his car. Who does that? Find me one person on earth who says, that's where I want to keep my large sums of cash, in your car. Come on.
Cash-driven lifestyle is should be, I mean, that is just a fantasy football team name. This is the man that gave us do your civic duty, man.
Yep.
And it's the league that gave us strong-ass offer. Cash-driven lifestyle. So let's take him for his word. Okay. So let's say you're pulling out five figures. Let's say, let's go low, $12,000.
Yep.
Just went down the old bank, 12 G's cash. got to be in like hundreds, right? I mean, that's a lot of just physical
cash.
That's
a lot of hundreds. Yeah. Like you need a large like receptacle or something for that, don't you?
So what would you spend the cash on if, like, okay, he's got free car, free house. I'm sure he's got a country club to go to. It's free. I mean, grocery shopping? Like, what is he spending out to dinner? I assume that people just give him a free meal. But even then, what? Calhoun's by the river?
He's like, getting comped at Calhoun's. I guarantee that. He's
what do you get?
At Calhoun's.
How do you spend $12,000 in cash in Knoxville?
He's not buying asparagus. We know that. He did claim to not know what asparagus was.
He does not know what asparagus is in the old, yeah.
That's not on the grocery bill. I mean, I just really struggle to think what he might have been doing with that money, Dan. I just can't come up with anything. There's just not a real put your finger on it thought of what he might have been doing with those withdrawals, especially around unofficial visits by players to the school.
So from 2018 to 2020, so 3 years, so you have 150 weeks, okay, yep. Right? 156.
Yep.
75 of those weeks. So essentially every other week, he took four or five figures of cash.
Dang.
Now, I do not make $3.8 million a year. Ross, now that we have Ross, you know, but then Ross came along. He might be earning through. But what could you spend? I mean, I don't know. What would the average, you know, $5,000 in cash? Does he have a debit card? Is a university credit card?
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, do you literally walk into a bank and say, I need $5,000 every 2 weeks?
I guess so. I don't live the cash driven. Actually do use cash more than most people. But I'm like down the groceries, like you said, no asparagus, but other things. Mm-hmm. Like where else, you know, cash for your, like, I assume the car, they give him like a gas card for his gas. Is he paying for his own gas? No.
No.
CVS, like Walgreens. I never saw the man wear anything other than an orange Tennessee gear.
Right. It's a real mystery what that money.
I'm thinking it was more than $300 in that Chick-fil-A bag. I don't know.
Yeah, no kidding. The Chick-fil-A bag was the end of the bread loaf. Like, I've already given out $5,700, but I do have an extra $300 here to put in the Chick-fil-A bag.
He does go to Chick-fil-A. We know that.
Yeah.
Right? So there's something. I don't know. I'm having troubles with this explanation. I can't say he got away with it. He's banned for 6 years. I mean, that's a tremendous effort.
Yeah.
Tremendous effort, but anyway, I don't know. Whatever.
I would have loved to have been sitting there for that interview with the NCAA and have him, like, first of all, he produces the bank records. Okay, he didn't stonewall them there like Will Wade did for, like, years at LSU. But he produces them, and it's like, they're like, well, what's all these withdrawals? Yeah, cash-driven lifestyle.
You got to be like, I play a lot of poker. I lose every time.
Yeah, that would be the play. That
strip
would be
club,
exactly the play.
Gentlemen's club. I don't know. I'm not sure an SEC head coach could spend $10,000 in cash in 2 weeks.
I don't
considering
think he could.
Everything that he gets for free.
Right. I really don't think you could.
So, well, you know, but, you know, we know that you know, there is. Here's the thing. Their recruiting wasn't that good. You know, do your own math on this. Do your own math. This guy was taking 10 G's out every 2 weeks, and it wasn't working.
No.
So,
do your own math.
No better than it normally does.
Don't win enough games. Get fired.
Anyway, he's out. Also, this thing is a treasure trove. Also in this is there was a great concern that Tennessee would be banned from a bowl, and the Tennessee Attorney General, Jonathan Scarametti, Tennessee Attorney General, so a politician, jumped in the fray He told the NCAA that a postseason ban, if they dared to issue a postseason ban, it would violate state law because it would prohibit the player's ability to earn money for their name, image, and likeness. Because they would then be, obviously, if the Tennessee team this year made a bowl game, they would have an opportunity to play an extra game and they would be able to make money. And thus, the Tennessee state law prohibits anyone from stopping that. And so the NCAA could not ban them. And he sent a letter on March 31st to make it clear. Tennessee, quote, Tennessee law prohibits the NCAA from imposing such a sanction. I will not hesitate to vindicate the rights of UT students to enjoy the full measure of their intercollegiate athletic opportunities. NCAA rules cannot supersede Tennessee law. The attorney general from the top rope. And it may have worked.
I mean, it may have. I mean, they didn't get the bowl ban. And whether that was a chilling effect on the room or if they were discussing that or not, I don't know. But I think also Greg Sankey was also weighing in, I think, in favor of a fine as opposed to a bowl ban. So
he shouldn't be weighing in at all.
No, he shouldn't. Yeah. But he attended the hearings. I cannot factually say he sat in the hearing room and weighed into that effect. But that's been his position, and I am sure his position was known to those people. But yes, the attorney general said that, you know, if the players don't get to go play in the Gator Bowl, they're losing out on money. How much money? I mean, I don't know. Are NIL payments really that closely tied to bowl game appearances? Not right now. So, you know, it's an interesting creative attempt, and maybe it worked. But that was Sankey, like today, was, I thought, pretty strong. And we can talk about this here shortly, obviously, about keeping state laws, like, just instead of having this hodgepodge of state laws flexing on what you can and can't do, that let's have a more uniform law. And I think this was kind of part and parcel of it. It's like, we can't just have some attorney general threatening the NCAA here in order to get their way.
Yeah, so Scrimeti cited Tennessee Code 49-7-2803. Again, Knoxville News here. And it says an athletic association's governing action, basically the NCAA or the SEC, must not interfere with an intercollegiate's ability to earn compensation in accordance with this part and must not otherwise impact an intercollegiate athlete's eligibility of full participation unless the intercollegiate athlete has committed a violation of the rules. So in other words, the guys on the team were not the ones doling, getting the Chick-fil-A bags. And Scrimeti, I mean, just classic politician. These rules are consistent with basic human decency. Kids who do no wrong should not be punished. All right. So that's it. So like when we talk about this mean, it means more. This is what we're talking about.
Yes. The attorney general is threatening to sue the NCAA to keep Tennessee from getting a bowl ban. That's exactly
in a case where Tennessee committed 200 violations. Okay, this isn't like nothing happened here.
Right.
Jeremy Pruitt took the rule book and lit it on fire. Mm-hmm. And claimed that he was dropping 10 G's a week on petty cash around Knoxville. Okay, come on. And yet, the attorney general went to the wall, was willing to spend taxpayer money to sue the NCAA over this law. That's what they mean when it just means more. Is your attorney general going to do that?
That's right. Ohio, Michigan, come on. Pennsylvania, California. I don't see your attorney general stepping up and threatening the NCAA every time one of your schools gets in trouble. Let's go.
I think it's fair to say Governor Scrimeti is going to be swept enough. Wait a minute. Ross.
Hi, guys.
Are you here? Y'all? Are you in?
How you doing?
Ross Dellinger of Yahoo Sports is
here. Ross, we already discussed how much more you must like me than Pat. Could you please confirm this? Yeah.
It's all true. Bush Light over Sierra Nevada.
Yeah. Coming around.
I used to think you had taste.
Now yeah, I can't. I can't. I really can't say that one with a straight face. Yes. Sorry, I was late. It's been a hectic day of day one of SEC Media Days, but I assume y'all have broached some interesting topics as always.
Yeah. Well, let's get to this part because Sankey talked about it today. Dear Leader took the microphone here in Nashville and gave a excellent speech, I thought. I cheered it a couple times, that mainly for the police officers that put out the, some good parts. It was a good speech. Disagreed with many of it, but that's all right. I'm very disagreeable. But he did bring up this point. And I am, even though he and I have vastly different opinions on what should happen with NIL and what politicians role in, this kind of stuff is ridiculous. You can't have, in my opinion, he took issue with these state laws in particular, among other things, that he said, we've seen a number of state laws, and we're talking, this crosses all political parties.
Yes.
Texas, New York, Oklahoma, Tennessee, everyone's doing this. We've seen a number of state laws enacted that bar associations, the NCAA or conferences, including the Southeastern Conference, from enforcing policies. In other words, the states haven't been active enforcing their NIL laws. Now states are preventing the NCAA or conferences from adopting and enforcing reasonable name, image, and likeness standards. Okay, so they're basically saying, just as we said, that the NCAA can't enforce its own rules. And I agree with them. This is ridiculous. The NCAA is a voluntary organization that you join. I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago with this. And if you go and join the NCAA or you join the SEC, you sit around and you make your own rules like any organization. Could be the garden club. It could be a country club. It could be a church. It could be whatever your local Friday night poker group. And it's say, if somebody doesn't show up 5 weeks in a row, they're no longer in the club, right? Mm-hmm. You say, okay, you're not in the club anymore. You didn't show up at the poker game or bringing in a new guy. You're out.
Yep.
You can't have a state law going, no, you can't throw anyone out of the poker game. It's like this is just a group of people that get together voluntarily and want to do their thing. And now we have state laws. This is the government interfering in the personal decisions of individuals and individual entities. It is government overreach to the nth degree, and it's all done because everybody hates the NCAA. But the NCAA is the schools.
Right.
Yeah. I don't like this. Attorney General should not be involved in this, as funny as it is.
Yeah. Well, no, we're getting good, like free market Dan here right now. Like,
free market me. Yeah. I'm like the only last one. And damn, Rand Paul sold me out recently. Nobody is free market anymore.
Yeah, no,
everybody wants the government.
You don't want
involved.
Regulation, yes, but that's the thing. And that's the problem. And I agree with Sankey here, like 85% is that. There's three tracks, basically, we're looking at here with NIL. National uniform legislation, state-by-state self-interested hodgepodge, or no regulation, right? I fall with Sankey more in the national regulation. I think that would be better than nothing, and I certainly think it would be better than the, let your attorney general threaten the NCAA school. So that's where I fall in on this. But that's the problem is this is just like conference realignment. Everybody's in it for themselves, state by state. And it's like, yeah, well, if Tennessee has this law, then God darn it, Alabama needs to have a law too, or rescind their law that's restrictive of our NIL chances here. And so it just becomes we get the SEC all over again in each of these individual state legislators. And that's not a way to have a policy. So it's I liked most of what Sankey had to say today.
Yeah, and this is something that he's obviously been preaching about for some time. in back in May, I think he used the words, I believe he used the words something like ruining the state lawmakers or making a mockery or making a circus, something like that, of college athletics, which I think probably some schools, disagreed with, actually, maybe some of his own schools, because like you said at the top, right, these are the school, this is the school's own doing. You know, they're encouraging their lawmakers to pass laws that give them the advantage, although these advantages are not long term. These are probably short term type of advantages. And I think Greg Sankin, I think he was asked about this today in the main media room, but he's had conversations, I think, with his own schools about not doing this, right? Not stop encouraging your lawmakers to pass state laws where you get this short-term advantage, but that allows you to, break NCAA rules and prohibits NCAA enforcement. You guys remember the memo that came out in late June, where the NCAA kind of further clarified its NIL guidelines and basically saying that schools must follow the NCAA rules even if they conflict with state laws. In entities such as school foundations are prohibited from NIL and offering donor incentives to NIL, which A&M and several schools plan on doing. And I remember putting out how I summed it up was, schools are lobbying their state lawmakers to create laws that permit those schools to break the very rules that they created as part of the NCAA. And yep, all in an effort for this little short-term advantage. The thing is, it is slowing, right? The IRS memo that came out back in May or June, it slowed some things down. And I think Sankey and others' messages, I think things are slowing down. But, you know, for the most part, this is going to continue until, I don't know, I don't know what the end is. It's a race to the bottom, as they might say.
Yeah, that's the phrase Sankey used today. That was interesting, and to me, I think indicated his disdain for where this thing is going. And again, like, yes, all right, so his alternative, national legislation, Congress, let's go. But, I mean, Ross, you've covered this as much as anybody. Is Congress ain't going to go there, are they? What's the chances of a national legislation on this?
Yeah, I think the chances of it happening this year, which the thought, as we've talked about, I know in the show quite a bit, the thought is that it needs to happen before the election cycle really hits full speed, which is like this winter, this fall. You know, the Congress goes on their annual summer recess starting the first week of August and is out for about a month.
And so they've been working hard.
Yeah. Over the next two to three weeks, Bill, this is a huge time for proposals to drop. And I think we are going to see some more Senate bills, NIL bills, be proposed over the next 2 to 3 weeks, maybe, because it's a really critical time for it to happen. And those bills will be digested. And then after they get back from recess, the thought is that they go and get argued seriously by committees. But, man, it would be real surprise if something gets done this year. It would be really quick. But I will say there is a lot of movement, more movement than we've ever seen. I think we could have as many as 3 Senate bills come to life here. But I don't know that any of them will move through the legislative system quickly.
Here's my problem. You're asking politicians. You see what happens when politicians get involved. Okay, they come up with these kind of rules. Like, you have both political parties, but you have people who are supposedly free market, right? Anti-government regulation, anti-government interference, literally having the government interfere not in like business regulations or environmental regulations, but in private associations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they give up so fast. Why? Because the NCAA is an easy punching bag, right? You can hate the NCAA. You can think their rule book is ridiculous. You can think that they should have caved years ago. You can laugh at all their self-inflicted mistakes. I'm all with you, but it's a voluntary organization. And so the schools are the NCAA. It's not the president of the NCAA. There's no omnipotent dictatorship in Indianapolis. They're just doing whatever they've been told to do by the, quote, membership, to use their parlance. And let me take this example, right? So the SEC has come out with a new storm the field. You talked about it today with Sankey, Pat. Mm-hmm. The storm the field rule. You can be fined up to $500,000 if your fans storm the field or the court or whatever. And the new rule says that the money will go to the team that you stormed on. So if you beat Alabama and you want to storm the field, the fans want to storm the field, your school is going to cut a check to Alabama, which they can then use as cash-based lifestyle if they so choose, right? So that's their rule. Kind of funny, I think. I think it's kind of funny. But what if a state law comes out and says you can't give our public money to another state? Can they come in and supersede and say that's not allowed with us? And the SEC's got to go, oh, I guess we can't enact that rule because we can't violate state law. You can't have a state law come and it's like, this is the rule the 14 SEC schools came up with. They had a meeting, they had a number of meetings, and this is the rule they came up with. Thought, hey, maybe that'll keep some of the fans in the stands. They think they're actually making Nick Saban more money. So you like, but the politicians go with it, and they go with it in New York, and they go with it in Oklahoma. And I imagine those two governing bodies don't have a whole lot in common amongst their membership because screw the NCAA. We're not going to, you know, they're easy to pick on. So that's like the mentality is just score cheap political points. It's not, there's no basis for anyone who believes in anything. Nobody has any backbone of their, no convictions of belief. There isn't anyone going, wait, we shouldn't do this. That's ridiculous. And they just vote for it and go. So now these are who we're talking about. Now you're sitting there going to the federal level. You're going to say, oh, these guys will have our best interests at heart. And they won't just play a bunch of gamesmanship and come up with stupid ideas like this. You cannot count on them. That's why in the end, your door number three, no regulation is going to be the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably right because that's where we're headed, right? But how
the politicians will make it worse.
They will. But how are people going to react to that?
How do they react that one coach makes more? I watched Eli Drinkwitz today say, well, we lost our offensive line coach in July or something. He went and took a different job. There was no outrage. I don't even know where they went. Right? Didn't he say, well, I think it was an old line, some assistant coach. He's like, we had to replace our line coach late. Yeah, he took a different job. Maybe he got paid more. Maybe he had to. That's just the way it is. There's no regulation on these coaches and administrators and everyone else switching jobs. Just let it go. You cannot count on politicians to solve your problem because they will come up with worse ideas like this one. And then you've got this grandstanding attorney general in Tennessee. God bless him, he delivered for the Vols. But as an enterprise, I think even a volunteer fan would have to say, this probably isn't a good idea.
Depends which volunteer fan.
It's worked for us this time.
The ones I hear from on Twitter would like that guy to be president of the United States.
Well, look, it's like no one wants to get a speeding ticket, but I think almost all of us understand there needs to be a speed limit.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And then, yes, how good is your lawyer getting out of the speed ticket? I'm with you on that. It's just I think that eventually this again, we've talked about this. The market will continue to settle down. We'll probably all be okay. The signs of the apocalypse were all completely overblown. But boy, oh boy, we are going to continue to hand-wring and consternate and go through iterations of very bad ideas of how to fix this along the way to wherever we're going.
All right. Speaking of potentially bad ideas or great ideas, or just great ideas for us. Jimbo Fisher, Texas A&M coach, was at the microphone today. And he was asked about, we hired Bobby Petrino, and we're not going to play the song. We'll spare you. First time you get
you
shut out,
it in
we're
the
playing
background.
The song. Yep. We won't all play the song. We'll spare Bobby Petrino this much. But he was hired to be the offensive coordinator, and the two run very different offenses, at least according to everyone else. Jimbo couldn't believe that question, seemed to think that that wasn't the case. And then he was asked who was basically going to be the primary play caller for the team, because Jimbo has always been the play caller, and he sidestepped it. I'm not going to get into that. Bobby was hired for a reason. Tremendous guy, tremendous football mind. Hopefully he'll call the game and have suggestions. I'm not going to get into what we're doing from a schematic viewpoint. Pat?
Way to squash everything, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, that Texas A&M will be must-watch just to see what's going on with the sideline cameras. And I guess Bobby's going to be in the box, and Jimbo's going to be on the field, and Jimbo will have his usual Waffle House menu-sized play sheet. And who's talking on the microphone? Who's talking into the headset leading up to plays? I would like to see. I would like to know. Because usually the head coach, if he's not calling the plays, is going to be pretty quiet and listening to what the coordinators are calling. So is that the way this is going to break down or not? We'll find out. But we are talking about two alpha male egocentric play callers who have had a lot of success calling plays. And technically now, theoretically, the play caller should be Bobby Petrino and Jimbo should be more in the CEO role. But especially, all right, close games, tight situations, third downs, who's doing the talking on the headsets? That's what I want to see.
Well, you know, coaches would tell you that we in the media probably spend too much time on you know, who calls the plays or who doesn't, because a lot of them will say it's more, especially if you have an offensive head coach, it is a collaborative effort more so. And I'm thinking that we're going to have, at least it sounds like we're going to have a collaborative effort. The issue is, as Pat said, you've got two pretty strong personalities, and collaborating in the middle of a fiery, you know, game where everybody's kind of fired up and there's emotion involved. That is, I wonder if that will work. I wonder if that will, if collaboration will work in a situation with these two men in the middle of a game, a heated game. So that's something I'm interested in learning about.
Yeah, it will be. This is going to be fun. I don't know. It all depends if it's working. That's all it's going to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. They definitely did not squash it here during time. You'd think he would have had a prepared answer. Maybe that was his prepared answer. Another interesting one, Northwestern fallout sort of continues. Amazingly, Northwestern keeps saying they don't really have a comment. There's been no press conferences or anything. They're now getting sued by at least 12 former players in a lawsuit, plus Pat Fitzgerald. They also fired their baseball coach for, I don't know what they, I don't forget what they termed it, but a less than ideal team environment or whatever. So a lot going on at Northwestern, of all places. And I thought this was a very interesting question or answer. That is a good question, but they asked Brian Kelly, LSU was there, and obviously, and he was asked about the Northwestern situation and like how do they handle that in his program and all of that. And he said this. So Brian obviously coached at Notre Dame, and they used to play Northwestern every once in a while, I guess. He said, look, it's a very difficult situation because I know Pat and I have the utmost respect for him as a person, as a family man, as a father. But the reality of it is coaches are leaders of their program. When things are not going the way they should be, there's an accountability. And I don't think he's somebody that would walk away from accountability at any time. And I'm not here to speak for him, but I can tell in my situation that a head coach is walking around those halls. A head coach is in the locker room. A head coach is eating with his team. A head coach knows his leadership team, which is kind of like their senior group or whatever. He also has many other support staff members that are in constant contact with his football team, the strength staff, your mental performance teams. You have so many different outlets to touch these players on a day-to-day basis. That's how we operate within our program. Sure sounded to me like, yeah, Pat must have known. or should have known. That am I? How am I taking that, Pat?
Yeah, that's yeah, no, that was the easy overt reading of that. And Brian Kelly, look, is as polished basically as a microphone, other than the Southern accent snafu upon arriving in Baton Rouge. But other than that, he's as polished with the microphone as about anybody in his profession. He's been a head coach for like 30 years. He's from a political family. He knows what he's doing. And so I thought he, without throwing Pat Fitzgerald under the bus, made his opinion clear that Pat Fitzgerald absolutely basically got what came to him here. Is either
kind of threw him under the bus.
Yeah. Yeah. Either you knew or you should have known. And if this stuff was going on in your program, here's what you get. You get fired. So I thought that was very interesting from him. And I think probably, look, there's some people within the coaching profession that are like, I can't believe after all Pat Fitzgerald's good work for all nearly 20 years that he gets nuked on this. And I can understand that point, but this is pretty serious if you're a university and you're looking at what's transpired or what's been thrown onto your plate from an investigative standpoint. And even nearly 20 years plus his playing career plus his assistant coaching career can be negated by something like this. And I think Brian Kelly kind of laid it out, man. You know, like head coach goes down with that ship if the ship's done hit that iceberg, the hazing iceberg, the naked hazing iceberg, as we've made that point. I was struck by the candor from Brian Kelly. He did not dodge that question at all.
Yeah, and we're used to coaches certainly dodging a question like that pretty easily, sidestepping it. But we're also used to Brian Kelly being pretty blunt and honest at times, and he was again there. Because yeah, I think most people would say that you know, a head coach like a Pat Fitzgerald that's so respected by former players and other coaches, that he is around his team and around his players a lot and knows what's going on in his program, especially something as significant as all this. And Brian kind of in a way that he often does kind of laid it all out there.
All right, Big 12 media days. The Big 12 conference deputy commissioner Tim Weiser, who is, I'm not talking about the associate commissioner of leaking that the Big 12 has. I don't know what it is. I don't know if that's Tim's job or not. I don't know who the leaker is.
I kind of think that they don't even leave that to an associate commissioner.
Yeah. Might be the head commissioner. Yeah. Well, anyway, Tim Weiser. The Big 12 took some shots at the departing Texas and Oklahoma, who, of course, will head to the SEC next season. They got one more season. His bit was, this was pretty good. Weiser said, I continue to maintain that the choice Texas made wasn't a financial one, because we all know what Texas's resources are like. I think there was more about affiliating with a group of schools that, on a given Saturday, they would rather get beat by Alabama than they would Kansas State or Florida than Iowa State. That, I think, was really driving the way they looked out down the road. Let's start with that part. I mean, that's a nice burn, huh, Ross?
You know what? I think it came out wrong, probably, or it came out a little... maybe too honest.
Saltier than expected? No.
I think he's right. I think in a lot of ways he's right. I feel like I understand what he's saying, right? And that is they're looking at the long-term future of college athletics, and they want to be in the club. And the SEC is the club to be in. They want to – it came out as – A typical lover that has been dumped. That's what it came out. It came from, and so you've got some anger behind there. But I think he's right in a way that, yeah, Texas wants to compete with the teams in the SEC instead of the Big 12, and probably is thinking more long term. But because this is a somewhat jilted lover. I think it came out as, oh, they want to get beat by, you know, all these other teams instead of our teams. But I think there's some truth that lies in there.
I think there's multi-level truth there. I think that, yes, that, like, okay, the SEC is, or the Big Ten is where you want to be eventually, and they could do it. But knowing Texas people, yeah. I mean, it burns their ass that they couldn't beat. It does. Baylor and TCU and Kansas State and Iowa State and even Kansas a couple of years ago. It absolutely does. I brought this up, I'm pretty sure, on the pod before. But going back to like 2014 or something, when they were getting rid of one coach, bringing in another coach. Maybe it was Mac Brown out. Maybe it was 2012. And anyway, I was talking to a guy who was a Texas alum of some stature or whatever. And I asked him, I said, what about Art Briles? Like, the Baylor coach? This is before Art Briles had any stink on him, you know? None of the scandal stink. But it's like, we're not hiring the Baylor coach. What if the Baylor coach is beating you? What if the TCU coach is beating you and the Texas Tech coach? So that, I think, has been very hard for them to swallow. But I would imagine the cooler heads maybe at the top of the food chain were more like, yeah, we need the SEC money and the SEC power with ESPN.
I kind of, though, they don't need the money. That's the thing. Well, so I do think they want more exciting opponents, but I'm going with it. They want to get Alabama. It's a lot easier to look in the mirror. Look, you're out at a bar and you're a single guy and you try to chat up the girl that's out of your league and you get swatted away. It's a lot better than the one that you thought you were out of their league.
Well, yeah.
It feels better.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be one thing, right? I think that a group of things led to this decision, and I think you highlighted there one of them, right? More exciting opponents, more exciting games, more big TV games, spotlight. All that stuff. The long-term future of college athletics, being in the whole club thing, and yeah, getting beat by certain schools certainly looks better than getting beat by others.
And when you have Oklahoma and Texas, they play each other, obviously, in Dallas at the state fair, and it's a great scene, but your home schedule isn't very exciting if your fans are trained to look down on all these other Big 12 teams. But wait, Deputy Commissioner Weiser was not done. He's our person of the week. He goes on and says, in Oklahoma's case, I'm not as convinced that was the issue for them. I think they were more of what I would call the reluctant bride. They kind of felt like, wow, if we don't go, what happens to the Texas OU football game, basketball? All the things that we know from an OU and Texas standpoint are really important. So I kind of felt like if I was in Oklahoma's case, it would have been hard for me to not think about the long term. And don't we want to be affiliated with Texas and now these other schools? The reluctant bride Sooners. Mm. Oh, ouch.
Burn.
Dear leader Sankey responded today to On Three, maybe somewhere. I don't know where this came. I didn't hear him say this. I'm going to be as clear as I can, he said. Now, you know when they, yeah. That's fiction, because that's how you talk when you're like an angry parent. I want to be clear.
Oh, yeah.
Period. I'm going to be as clear as I can. That's fiction, period. That's fiction. The outreach was both equitably. It was from the presidential level directly from both presidents or whatever. As I recall, they said, we've watched how you've led, which is a compliment to me. See, this is how dear leaders talk. And how our group has made decisions and how we function. And they want to be as part of that. That's as clear as I can be. Do you think that these guys were looking for administrative comedy? Not comedy. C-O-M-I-T-Y. Or were they looking for bags of cash from the SEC and better opponents? Because let me tell you what, earlier this thing, we had the attorney general of a state usurp all the rules. So I don't really know how well the thing's been working together, how it's been functioning. But that's what Sankey said.
I think there's some truth in what Tim Weiser had to say. Now, look. Oklahoma is also smart enough to be able to read the room and say, oh, okay, I mean, if Texas is even thinking about it, we better think about it. And if Texas is going to jump, we better jump too. Now, is that reluctant or not? And I, as great as Oklahoma football has been, which historically is better than Texas football, you can look it up if you go back to the 50s. I mean, there's clearly Oklahoma has been a more successful football program than Texas has been historically. But in terms of who is driving the Big 12 bus and who would where the Big 12 bus would be going without Texas, it still may be going in the ditch. So Oklahoma was like, if they're going, we got to go too. Now, I'm not sure they would have been reluctant for sure, but I don't think they were the initiator, and I don't think they were the most important party in that.
Well, and it's kind of like USC, UCLA a little bit, right? We got shades of there's similarities there. USC driving the bus, Texas driving the bus, and hey, rival, do you want to come with us? We're leaving no matter what. And I think that rival in both cases was probably wisely decided to jump on the bus. I think certainly Oklahoma made a wise decision with that. I think there are some that would say that UCLA's decision was different and maybe not as wise, but I think there are definitely similarities in what happened there. There's definitely one program making the decision, driving the bus, and another kind of tagging along, so to speak. But I would be shocked if the word reluctant was anywhere in the conversation for what OU decided.
The reluctant bride. I mean, we are getting terms on terms this week. I believe Shakespeare wrote, "Hell hath no fury like a Big 12 deputy commissioner scorned." Maybe I got that wrong.
Shakespeare, beat writer, Dallas Morning News. Yeah.
All right, we got this one. I know it's basketball, but this is just great. Hunter Dickinson, who played 3 years, a big star at the University of Michigan, which is located in Ann Arbor, Michigan, has transferred as a while ago to Kansas University, which is located in Lawrence, Kansas. And he was on the Rock Chalk Unplugged podcast, and he was discussing the move. And he said part of it was just how nice people are in Lawrence is so far. A quote, "Just walking around, the people are super, super welcoming, super nice. Definitely get those Midwest vibes." Now, Dickinson is from the D.C. area. "I think Michigan, they weren't as nice. Like, they were nice people, but not as nice." Here's a quote. "I feel like Michigan's like a fake Midwest. Kansas is actually a Midwest town."
Uh-oh.
End quote. Now, is there a more ridiculous debate than whether something is fake Midwest or real Midwest? No, there is not, which is why we are tackling this.
That's right.
Pat 40, is Michigan fake Midwest? I am going to abstain till later because I have personal ties here.
But yes,
Kansas the real Midwest and Michigan's fake Midwest?
Here's what this boils down to. Not fake Midwest versus real Midwest. Basketball school versus football school. They're a hell of a lot more friendly to the 7-foot basketball center in Lawrence, Kansas than they are in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Just as if Blake Corum had transferred from Michigan to Lawrence, Kansas, they would miss him a lot more in Ann Arbor than they would like him in Lawrence. That's what this is about. So fake or not, we can go into many geographic things. I will say, like, the accent in Michigan just seems quintessentially Midwest to me. And the Kansas is a little bit more twangy. But you got the short A's and the long O's in Michigan. That's Midwest to me.
I have spent all of 20, 30 hours in the state of Michigan in my life. And it recently happened this past summer. So I am not one to weigh in on this issue, but I did detect, as Pat said, more of the Midwestern accent in Michigan, certainly, than Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't grow up in Michigan, so I don't have that accent. I can't speak at all. So I don't know.
We're aware.
I cannot.
The listeners are aware too.
They are aware too.
I don't know. So, all right. I will say this. I think Hunter Dickinson is correct.
Yeah. Mm.
I think he is correct. Kansas is the plains.
Mm.
Right? It's there is almost nothing in common between Kansas and Michigan. They're two totally different places. The idea that they're just the first, if they're not even close, it's probably like 1,000 miles between the two of them or something. To group them all as Midwest is something that someone from the East Coast or the West Coast would say, right? It's like those map of like how New Yorkers see the world. It's like Jersey, and then there's like nothing, and then there's like Vail or something.
Yeah.
Kansas is far nicer. Nobody's nice in Michigan. We're not nice. We're nicer than maybe some places, but we're not nice. Detroit is not nice.
I get the feeling you like it that way.
Absolutely. You can take your fake Midwest and go to Kansas if you want. We're not nice. There's nothing nice going on in Michigan. We're not nice people. I mean, you know. I don't
760
think so.
Miles, by the way, from Lawrence Stanley.
760. So I agree. It should be like they should call Michigan the Mideast, which, of course, they're not going to, but it's that. It's not really Midwest, or they call it Rust Belt or whatever. Like these towns and cities in Ohio and Michigan, Chicago, they're not nice. Like now, maybe you go out there to Lawrence, it's all hearts and flowers, and, you know, so go look at the wheat fields, and you're not getting that. So I agree. But I think your point is accurate, Pat. I think they're really nice to J.J. McCarthy.
Yeah.
Blake Corr. Yeah. I don't think like Aiden Hutchinson really worried about it. Yeah.
Uh-uh.
Hunter just wasn't getting the love. He just wasn't getting the love because
Sean, our producer, by the way, just sent a quadrant map of the U.S. that about who acts nice versus who is nice and who acts mean versus is mean. And okay, Kansas is split in half. Kansas is cut in half. And really, the Lawrence side is under, it's almost like right on the border of two different things. It acts nice is mean between, or acts mean is nice. So that's a fault line right there. Whereas Michigan is very solidly in the acts mean is nice category. I think that's you, Dan Wetzel. I think you act mean, but you have a heart of gold.
Acts mean is nice. How does that work?
I mean, that's, you know, if people cut you open, they could see your soft, friendly interior.
Yeah.
I don't recommend cutting you open. Let's not.
No. Let's try to avoid that.
Thankfully, none of us live in the southwest region of the country. I don't know that western. West Texas, north New Mexico, Arizona, in Southern California, in parts of. I don't know, whatever. Utah, Nevada. Acts mean is mean. Damn.
I mean, I can see some of that.
Fake Midwest.
By the way, Dan, to your point about...
Who would fake it? Nobody wants
Midwesterners, Dan. Midwesterners fake it.
Let's fake it. Let's be Midwest. Nobody's faking the Midwest.
Of course, us Southerners are the real fakesters, right? We act really nice, but... When you leave, we're talking
nice
behind your back.
Mean.
That's right.
That's what it says right there.
Yeah. But Dan, to your point about how close or how far away, I should say, that Lawrence, Kansas in Ann Arbor are, New York City in Columbia, South Carolina are closer than Ann Arbor, Michigan Lawrence, Kansas. 700 miles between New York City in Columbia, South Carolina, and as Pat said, 760 between Ann Arbor and Lawrence. So, yeah, not close.
There's nothing in common between Kansas people and I guess there's probably some spot in Michigan that's very rural that might have, but Kansas is a very rural state, and Michigan is generally not. There's some areas, but like people don't really live there. So, whatever. We're fake. Fake Midwest. Michigan's a fake Midwest. I think Hunter, very perceptive of Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Very perceptive. I have so Pat 40, we're going to go to, we got to get out of here because we got to go to this meet and greet here. We got to go drink basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty much.
By the way, I had the book fair in Detroit, and there was like 8 or 9 different pod listeners came. Fantastic. I can't name them all. They came in, stopped by, selling books. It was great. Great time. So we'll see if anyone shows up at this thing. Might not, but whatever. But if you want to know where Pat's mindset is, and this is probably why Ross bailed on him, came to work for Yahoo. So we've been doing this podcast for about 58 minutes or something, 50-something minutes. 26 minutes ago, Pat Forty answered a tweet. He was asked for a good recommendation for food and drink. He was asked by @flounder76 on Twitter. Would appreciate some good recommendations for food and drink in Chapel Hill. And Pat, because, I mean, you can't leave Flounder76 waiting, answers. The Crunkleton, top of the hill, many good spots in the Franklin Street area. Pat Forty, can we get you to focus on the pod and not drink recommendations in Chapel Hill? Or are you just so far, you are fake podcast Midwest. That's what you are.
Well, currently he's coming back to his seat.
He didn't hear any of that.
He didn't hear any of that, which might be good for him.
Yeah, maybe. What just transpired?
You took off and then the 90 just proved your point, Dan. You were gone. Dan didn't realize that you were gone. You were gone, and Dan just decided to go in on you a little bit.
Okay.
There.
Yeah, really? First off, where were you?
What am I killed for?
Where were you?
Little bathroom break. I've had a Tennessee IPA here.
Enough. All right, enough. Okay. Yeah. Okay. You were asked 30 minutes ago in an hour-long podcast, 30 minutes ago, at Flounder76, asked you for a drink recommendation in Chapel Hill. And 4 minutes after Flounder76, so important, this at Flounder76, you immediately respond, the Crunkleton, top of the hill, many good spots. Yeah. On Franklin Street. Are you focused at all on anything other than alcohol?
I am locked in on this podcast.
You're answering tweets from Flounder76?
Hey, Flounder asked a better question than you've asked all day. It was, where do you drink in Chapel Hill? It's an important, pressing question. He's there right now. He's got to go out.
Well, you missed that what Dan launched this whole discussion with, which was, and this is probably the reason Ross left Pat for me.
Yes, yes. At least I'm all about business here.
Oh, my goodness.
Speaking of business, the Bush Light awaits at Tootsie's.
Yeah, we got to go. We're out of topics. The pod is done. Continue to subscribe. Share on social media. We appreciate all of you. We'll be back. There'll be plenty more to come. Talk to you later.